Well, dear brethren, Austin's subject is an Old Testament jewel. So I'm looking forward to that. There's a kind of a special day for myself going back a little bit in memory lane. I remember when Austin came to the States. This was the first convention that he actually visited or was part of back in 1985. So it was a special day. I could see him full of bubbles, just the way he is right now. There's nothing changed except he's been a blessing all through these years that I know him. As a matter of fact, we had hit it off in the beginning. He calls me Dad today. So I recall these days, and they're special. And here you are, and this is the first time that he's been on the convention, not on the program, but giving a discourse. So Lord bless you, Brother Austin, as you tell us about an Old Testament jewel.
Thank you, Brother Byrne. Thank you, Brother Brian. Brother Ken talked about Hebrews 6 as a chapter. We will not talk about a chapter. We'll talk about an entire book. Brethren, journey with me to the book of Ruth. And the purpose and lessons involved in this book are manifold. We'll touch upon all of them. This book of four chapters is intended to provide us a lineage for King David in earlier times, and also to form a contrast in its peaceful and pastoral simplicity to the disorders which appear in the book of Judges. By way of background, the story of Ruth, the Moabitess, is a tale of love, devotion, and redemption. It is fitting that this little book is situated between Judges and 1 Samuel. And we'll revert back a little bit to the book of Judges for a moment. It chronicles the Israelites' failure to live according to God's holy standards. How do we know that? The book ends with immorality in chapter 19, Judges 19. Civil War, chapter 20. Murder and kidnapping, chapter 21. The complete rebellion of the children of Israel is summed up in the last verse of Judges 21:25. Judges 21:25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. The lawless period of Judges provides the backdrop for the book of Ruth. However, God always had a remnant that remained faithful to him. So we found during the period of post-Exodus and until Samuel anoints Saul as the first king of Israel. And we call that period Judges. Nothing in the book of Judges is mentioned regarding a famine breaking out in the land. However, the opening verses of the book of Ruth does indicate of such an occurrence. That is when a family comprised of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah called Elimelech, who along with his wife Naomi and two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, sojourned from Bethlehem southeast toward Moab. Once they reach Moab, the two sons take for themselves Moabite women as their wives, called Ruth and Orpah. Point number one, the tragedy at Moab. Now journey with me, chapter 1, Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. It's a beautiful narrative containing a story within a story. What do I mean by that? The inside story is revealed through the names of the principal characters. And definitions is always helpful. A man named Elimelech, which means, my God is king, married a woman named Naomi, which means pleasant or pleasure. And the couple had two sons. The first son's name was Mahlon, means sickly, And the second son's name was Chilion, which means wasting away. So the names of the sons reveal how the actions of the father probably brought misfortune to the sons. During a famine, Elimelech moved his family from their home in Bethlehem, meaning city of bread, to a neighboring country called Moab. So here is how we can define the names and link them together. When my God is king, dedicated his life for pleasure, disaster followed. Not much time passes by for this family in Moab before Elimelech dies, leaving behind his widowed wife and two sons and their respective wives. They all live there for about 10 years before the two sons also die, like their father, leaving behind three widows. Road to Bethlehem, verses 6 onwards. For foreigners to live in Moab, life was very difficult. Why? Because they could not own their own land, and they were forced to work for meager wages. Widows and orphans in Moab were at the bottom of the economic ladder. Things were especially hard for Naomi. First of all, poor widow had she had no family in the sense of immediate surroundings besides her daughters-in-laws, and was alone in a pagan land, separated from God's people and God's blessings. In the midst of her trials, Naomi's mind turned to God and to home. And word reached Naomi, verse 6, of how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. God was again blessing Israel with abundant crops, and Naomi begins to see the hand of God in her misfortunes. Verse 13. News comes to Naomi that things are getting better in Judah when she decides to return back to where she first came from. She makes up her mind to return to Bethlehem. And brethren, this is one of the old sayings, as most of you must have heard, but I'll repeat that again. Adam was the happiest man on earth. And you know why? He did not have a mother-in-law. And so was Eve. She didn't have a mother-in-law either. But this is where none of the mother-in-law jokes apply. The two daughters-in-law want to go with the mother-in-law to Jerusalem. And that scenario speaks very highly about Naomi's character. Brethren, we've got to look at the perspective. Women those days could not go out and become executives like today. How devastating must have been the situation for all three women, because the epitome of being successful in life in those days was to raise a family and have a home with a husband. None of that is possible for all these three women. Second point, third point, the statement of love, verses 8, 14 through 16, chapter 1. So it is a testimony of Naomi's character that both her daughters-in-law were willing to leave their country and follow her to Bethlehem. As the three women went about to make the three-day journey to Bethlehem, Naomi's mind probably turned to the future of the young women. Number one, she knew that they would be treated as outcasts in Bethlehem. Number two, their prospects for remarriage were non-existent. So Naomi stops and she speaks to her daughters-in-law by saying, "Go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as ye have dealt with the dead and me." Naomi's love for the young women is mature and selfless. Although it would be much safer for three women to travel together than for one woman to travel alone, Naomi considered the young women's welfare ahead of her own. Both Orpah and Ruth protest and express their desire to stay with Naomi. The old woman then explains to the young women what she has been thinking. Her arguments are very persuasive, and her arguments are verses 11 and 12. She has no more sons for the young women to marry, and even if Naomi gave birth to new sons, the women would be too old by the time the boys grow up. And this is where we come to something called a Levirate law. We'll touch upon it later. Definitions again. Orpha, what does it mean? It means fawn. And she considers Naomi's words and agrees that the cost of following Naomi is too high. Although the word fawn refers to a little deer, we also use the word to describe a superficial kind of love. For example, fawning over someone. When Orpah kisses Naomi, she demonstrates a deep affection, no doubt, but not enough real love to sacrifice her all in Naomi's behalf. So the young widow bids Naomi farewell and heads back to Moab and to her gods. Chapter 1, verse 15. Now Naomi turns to Ruth, and she said, "Behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her God. Return thou after thy sister-in-law." Now the definition of Ruth, it means a female friend. Now Ruth has also counted the cost, but she loves Naomi too much to leave her alone. Ruth's love for Naomi is self-sacrificing, and she thinks of Naomi's welfare before her own. With one stunning statement, Ruth separates herself from her home, her people, and her pagan gods. And that statement is found in verses 16 and 17. "Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee." Ruth is almost begging Naomi to allow her to continue with her. "Whither thou goest, I will go." Neither of the women knew what fate lay ahead of them. But Ruth was faithful to Naomi even when facing the unknown. "Where thou lodgest, I will lodge." There was no home for Naomi to return to, but Ruth was willing to stay with her even if it meant living on the street, in the street. "Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God." The faithful young widow was willing to forsake both her people and her gods to stay with Naomi. "Where thou diest, I will die, and there will I be buried." The young woman gladly faced death in an unknown place, separated from all she knew, for the opportunity to be buried in the same place as Naomi. And finally, she backs up her words with a solemn oath in verse 17. "The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." Does that vow sound familiar, brethren? Where are the chances a daughter-in-law making a vow to a mother-in-law, "until death do us part"? So Ruth's confession of faithfulness convinces Naomi of the young woman's determination to continue on with her. She starts off to Bethlehem and never brings up this topic ever again. What is the lesson, brethren? Ruth's statement, a beautiful example of the self-sacrificing love that believers should have for Christ. We should be willing to give up everything for the cause of Christ and live to please Him in all our ways. Evidently, Naomi has imparted her faith in God to her daughters-in-law. And of course, Naomi's faithfulness to God is rewarded by Ruth's faithfulness to her. So the tragedies in Moab awakened Ruth to the spiritual reality of God. When she is faced with a difficult choice, she declares her love to Naomi and her submission to God. Sometimes God uses the tragedies of others to draw people to Himself. When we experience adversity in our lives, we should not only pray for the deliverance, but also for the ultimate purposes of God to be fulfilled. Let's digress a little bit. Let's look at the history of Moabites. And some of it is a little graphic. Bear with me. One, they did not worship Jehovah God. Moabites in particular, here's somebody who doesn't worship the true God, but they were secure financially. They were secure when it came to the material things in life. Isaiah 15:7 tells us that. Isaiah 15:7. Therefore, the abundance they have gotten and that which they have laid up shall they carry away over the brook of the willows. Since both the Moabites and the Ammonites practiced human sacrifice, 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 26 and 27. 2 Kings 3, 26, 27. Most notable among them were Solomon's idols, were the ones he built for two gods of Moabites, Chemosh and Milcom, the chief gods of Moab and Ammon, respectively. The worship centers for these gods were built on a hill to the east of Jerusalem called Mount of Olives. Incredibly, brethren, the abomination stood within the site of the holy temple in Jerusalem, which Solomon had also built. And unless they were disguised by the noise of loud prayers and music, the screams of babies and young children being burnt alive would have been easily heard by those who gathered in the temple's courts to worship the Lord. A little bit background of the Moabites. Let's move to verse 19 through 21. So, the mother and daughter-in-law, they journey back. They travel by foot toward Bethlehem, arriving during the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, they've gone for 10 years. The reception they received was one of a pleasant nature. The people in the city recognized Naomi and were moved about them. She tells them, "Please do not call me Naomi anymore. Although the word means pleasant, instead call me Mara, bitter, because the Lord has dealt with her harshly, resulting in her before going with fullness and returning empty." Naomi felt they should have never left Judah, and hence God's punishments of her losing all three males in her life. "I went out full and came back empty." Did she come back empty? We'll look at that. So the lawless period of the Judges provides us a backdrop for the book of Ruth. Famine in the Middle East, ancient Middle East, was not uncommon, brethren. But for Israel, it was sometimes seen as a sign of God's judgment and his call to repentance. Elimelech attempted to escape the famine by moving his family to another country. Although the country was only 30 miles from Bethlehem in actual distance, but an infinite distance away in its relationship to God. Elimelech owned property which was left behind in Bethlehem before they relocated to Moab. When they returned to Bethlehem during the time of the harvest of barley, in order to redo the land, which was overgrown with thorns and thistles, and it was not cultivated for 10 years, it was a formidable task. Even if the task at hand was arduous, they had to live on something on a daily basis. For example, if they had arrived in New York or New Jersey or in America, they probably would have qualified for welfare. Whether they would have gotten the welfare is a different story. But the brethren, the welfare system the nation of Israel had was far superior than what we have today. And we'll see that. Now we'll move to journey to chapter 2, verses 1. Now Naomi was too old to go to the fields and glean, but Ruth did, because she was much younger and was able-bodied. The young widow had obviously studied the law of Moses. She immediately went out to find a field where she would be able to, or allowed to, pick up some leftover barley. Now we'll move to the law. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 22. Leviticus 23, 22. "And when ye reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field. Neither shalt thou gather the gleaning of the harvest, thou shalt leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am Jehovah your God. Deuteronomy 24:19-22. Deuteronomy 24:19-22. When thou reapest thy harvest in thy field, and hast forgotten a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go again to fetch it. It shall be for the sojourner, for the fatherless, for the widow, that Jehovah thy God may bless thee in all the work of thy hand. Why do you think this was instituted, brethren? Verse 22 will give us an answer. Deuteronomy 24:22. And thou shalt remember that wast a bondman in the land of Egypt. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. Means, remember in Egypt. Do not let this happen to you again. So the nation was so advanced when compared to all the other heathen nations around them, even if they applied and adhered to some of the laws and commandments, they would have been a better polity in themselves. This is the first time the name appears. Naomi had a relative of her husband called Boaz. He was a wealthy man with land and workers. And Ruth goes out to glean, and she comes across a part of the field owned by Boaz. She evidently caught his eye. Imagine, brethren, you all go to work every morning, and you're greeted by your supervisor or manager by these words, "The Lord be with you." How would that sound today? You'll probably get a lawsuit pretty soon. Discrimination or violation of one's rights of today, and we talk about a Christian nation, right? Who is the king of this nation? That's something for you to think about. Well, the reciprocal answer by the employees, "Lord, the Lord bless thee." Interesting. Evidently, Boaz had a very good relationship with his employees. So he inquires about Ruth's background from one of his overseer or foreman, and was told how Ruth had approached him and how diligently she has worked in the fields. Knowing that she's worked hard to support Naomi, Boaz is filled with admiration for her. Verses 1 through 7, chapter 2. So the foreman tells Boaz, "Wasn't this the person who returned with Naomi from Moab?" And so Ruth, chapter 2, verse 7. And Ruth talks now. And she said, "Let me glean, I pray you, and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." So she came and hath continued even from the morning until now, save that she tarried a little in the house. Then said Boaz to Ruth, "Hearest thou not, my daughter? Go not to glean in another field, neither pass from hence, but abide here fast by my maidens." Verse 9, "Let thine eyes be on the field that they do reap, and go thou after them. Have I not charged the young men that they shall not touch thee? And when thou art thirst, go unto the vessels and drink of that which the young men have drawn." So Boaz has a conversation with Ruth, and what emanates from the discussion gives us an indication that it was not a perfect society then as well as now. "Have I not charged the young men that they shall not touch thee?" At this point, Ruth does not know that Boaz is a near relative of her mother-in-law. Her intention is to simply glean enough barley for herself and Naomi. Yet a man she has just met has showed her great kindness. Verse 10, chapter 2, verse 10. "Then she fell on her face and bowed herself to the ground and said unto him, Why have I found favor in thy sight, that thou shouldst take knowledge of me, seeing I am a foreigner?" Verse 11. "And Boaz answered and said unto her, It hath fully been shown me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thy husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother and the land of thy nativity, and art come unto a people that thou knewest not therefore." Boaz explains that he's aware of how she has remained with Naomi since her tragedy in Moab. He knows how much she has given up to come to a foreign land with no family except a widowed old mother, a mother-in-law. He prays that God will repay Ruth in full for her sacrifice, and that just as a mother hen spreads her wings over her chicks to protect them, God will protect Ruth as she takes refuge under his wings. Verse 12. In the words that pass between Boaz and Ruth, we see that Ruth's self-sacrificing love is matched by Boaz's kindness. Ruth has gained a reputation for being faithful, loving and kind. Boaz's kindness to her is his way of rewarding her for her kindness to Naomi. Guided by the hand of God, she happened to go directly to the field of Boaz. Brethren, we are all forming opinions or reputations about one another. Everywhere we go, people watch us and form opinions about our character. What does your reputation say about you as a child of God? Verse 13. And then she said, "Let me find favor in thy sight, my Lord, for that thou hast comforted me, and for that thou hast spoken kindly unto thy handmaid, that I be not as one of thy handmaidens." And when she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not. And also put out some for her from the bundles, and leave it, and let her glean, and rebuke her not." So she gleaned in the field until even, and she beat out that which she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. What measure of barley was an ephah? An ancient Hebrew unit of dry measure equal to about a bushel, which is 48 pounds. Actually, it's quite a bit, brethren, because considering that Ruth had threshed the stalks and winnowed it, so the chaff was eliminated. It was only kernels. 48 pounds. That's incredible, isn't it? In one day. This is where we talk about harvesting. Let's touch upon harvesting in the days of old. The first phase of harvesting is a rule of thumb. Do not reap something which has not ripened yet. Like our Lord said, "Let them grow together until the time of the harvest, and lest ye uproot the wheat instead of tares until they are grown, fully grown." And the second aspect of harvesting is you chop the stalks, bundle them together, and these are called sheaves, and bring them to a central location which requires a smooth surface, usually made of clay, where they are laid down, and the cattle or horses, or depending on the financial condition of the farmer, human beings walk over it, while facilitating the separation of chaff from barley. And this is called threshing. Threshing. That's the second phase. And the third phase is winnowing, where the chaff and the barley are thrown up in the air with a winnowing fork so that the wind will do the separation of wheat from the chaff. And so the weather conditions have to be good for harvesting as well. In Matthew 3:7, our Lord points out the attitude and the wrong disposition being taught by the scribes and the Pharisees during the first harvest, which resulted in the separation of wheat and the chaff. In Matthew 13:30, the Lord having in his hand the winnowing fork, the separation of wheat and the tares. And finally, in Matthew 25:33, the separation of sheep and the goats. So when Ruth returns home that evening, she gives a detailed account as to what took place that day to her mother-in-law. What do you think Naomi's reaction was when she found out that Ruth has been gleaning in the field of Boaz? Verse 20. She was elated, exclaiming, "Blessed be he of the Lord, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." Naomi realized that God had not forgotten them, and it is all his blessings. So Naomi obviously encourages Ruth to go back to the same land, verses 21 through 23, as already been evaluated or further given by Boaz also. And as Naomi's temporal needs were being sustained, her thoughts immediately turned toward the bigger picture, the long-term well-being of Ruth. What does she do? She decides to sell the land. Thus, hoping from the proceeds of the sale, it will be better for her in the long term. By law, if you wish to sell the land, you need to sell it to the closest kinsman. And the closest kinsman, the other word is redeemer. And Naomi knew of only one person, Ruth chapter 3 verse 2, who happened to be Boaz. Is this a coincidence? I guess in the world, they may say, very lucky. We know the Lord's hands, brethren, here. There were specific requirements for someone to be a kinsman. And let's look at the law, what the requirements were. Leviticus chapter 25, verses 25 through 28. Leviticus 25, 25 through 28. If thy brother be wax poor, and sell some of his possession, then shall his kinsman, that is next unto him, come, and shall redeem that which his brother hath sold. And if a man have no one to redeem it, and he be wax rich, and find sufficient to redeem it, then let him reckon the years of the sale thereof, and restore the overplus unto the man to whom he sold it, and he shall return unto his possession. But if he be not able to get it back for himself, then that which he hath sold shall remain in the hand of him that hath bought it until the year of the Jubilee, and in the Jubilee it shall go out, and he shall return unto his possession. So here, I'll paraphrase that. He had to be a close relative and bear all the responsibilities. And the responsibility of the close kinsman was to help out and redeem what the impoverished relative had lost. And the third one, he has to marry the widow. In Ruth chapter 1:11-13, Naomi said, "Turn again, my daughters, why will ye go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb, that ye may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband, and if I should say I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight, and should also bear sons, would he therefore tarry till they were grown? Would he therefore stay from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes, for the hand of Jehovah is gone forth against me." And this is where we examine the Levirate law. Deuteronomy 25 verses 5 through 10. Deuteronomy 25 verses 5 through 10. If brethren dwell together, and one of them die, and have no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her, and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn that she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother that is dead, that his name be not blotted out of Israel. Keep that thought in your mind, because we'll come back to that as to how it transpired. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate unto the elders, and say, "My husband's brother refuseth to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel, and he will not perform the duty of a husband's brother unto me." Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak unto him. And if he stand and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders, and loose his shoe from off his foot, and spit on his face. And she shall answer and say, "So shall it be done unto the man that doth not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that hath his shoe loosed." It's interesting, the old custom, just give you one little bit of sense of reality. In some parts of the world, brethren, If you're spat on, it is the worst insult you could ever incur. And I don't know why this rule was, but this was the custom then. In Matthew 22, verses 24, and this is what happens, 15 to 24, sorry, and saying, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man die having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. Now there were with us seven brethren, and the first married and deceased, and having no seed left unto his wife, unto his brother." And what did the Sadducees have in mind? They tried to trick Jesus into about a woman having seven husbands. This is the reason why they tried to trick Jesus. So the stage is set for Naomi to sell the land to Boaz. And of course, all the city knew about Ruth's character by now. But there was a problem. What was the problem? Verse 12. Boaz was not the only kinsman. There was somebody ahead of Boaz as a kinsman. And so by virtue, it goes to him for him to buy the land. So Boaz finds out and he goes and mentions this to this new kinsman. And the new kinsman backs out of the entire situation, not because he didn't like Ruth, because when he came to know the law, and that is, if Ruth bears a child, that child will inherit the entire property. Whatever even he owns will go to her son's name. This person's name is totally blotted out. He says, no, this is a bad proposition. I don't want this. And so the bargain goes back to Boaz. And of course, Boaz buys the land because he's doing it according to the law. And he buys the land. And of course, by law, we know what happens. In verse 15, verse 10, it talks about how Boaz purchased the land and he marries Ruth. And then he bears a son. Was Naomi happy bearing a child? Verse 15 tells us how happy she was. Did she really come back empty, brethren? Ruth went to the field not to seek a husband. Boaz was not looking for a bride. It is the hand of God that brought the two together, demonstrating that it is better to be the right mate than to look for the right mate. Naomi did return to Bethlehem empty and bitter, bearing the evidence of God's disfavor. But then we see how the women in verse 14, chapter 4, verse 14, how they come back and tell, "Praise be the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer." Ruth obviously receives wonderful praise from the women. And it is interesting in verse 17. "And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. And he is the father of Jesse, the father of David." In the limited time we have, I'm not going to ask the chairman how much time I have, because he's going to say not enough. Lessons, brethren, from this narrative. Did Naomi come back empty? Brethren, she came back not empty, but with a precious jewel in the Old Testament. She did not know about that at that time when she made this proclamation, but the Lord provided for her in a most remarkable way. Have you experienced some unexpected sheaves and grain from the Lord that sweetened your life? In 1 John chapter verse 2, 1 John chapter 2 verses 15 through 17, this is a question we need to ask ourselves. Are we gleaning only in the field of Boaz, or are we in the fields other than Boaz? And the last one, this is a doctrinal point. The concept of kinsman redeemer points to the ministry of Christ. How do we know that? The word Strong's 1350, the word kinsman means ransom. Strong's 1350. also Redeemer. Again, must be related by blood to those he redeems. John 1:14 tells us who that is. John 1:14, he had to be able to pay the price of redemption. 1 Peter 1:18 and 19. 1 Peter 1:18 and 19. And he had to be willing to pay the price. John chapter 10 verse 18. Like Boaz, Christ met all these criteria and is thus eminently qualified to be the kinsman redeemer of all God's people. Blessed be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. Ruth chapter 2 verse 20. Amen.
Thank you, Brother Austin. It's always wonderful to see how many lessons, they're endless, that we can extract from the Old Testament, and not only that, but from the ancient worthies, and the pictures are, like we said, endless. We could go back, and by the time we get a new one, we forgot the other one. So it's a wonderful experience to have you up here, dear Brother Austin, and thank you for that thought on an Old Testament jewel.